Coming up on TechNation, are we humans better off today or maybe not? I speak with experimental cognitive scientist and Harvard professor Steven Pinker with his book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. He's got a lot of data. Then on TechNation Health, chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft takes us beyond the hype about artificial intelligence in healthcare. Is AI really in play? And where might AI be used in the near future? All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
There was a time in the 1980s when the chip industry in Silicon Valley was in real trouble. It wasn't that the engineers had problems coming up with new ideas or better technology. They were certainly in the solid embrace of better, faster, cheaper. But cheaper can mean a lot of things. That mantra is meant for the consumer. And let's remember, this was also a time before the World Trade Organization was created, and a nation's respect for intellectual property was a matter of choice. What was actually happening was twofold. The American chip companies were designing new chips, lickety-split, but manufacturing them was not a perfect process. In fact, it involved a lot of labor, and there were many opportunities for larger wafers, which held a number of identical chips, to be damaged or improperly produced. So when a company released new chips, it was expected that they weren't all perfect, and any problem chips would be replaced, also lickety-split. But that's not a great way to do business. A lot of effort was focused on the problems in the manufacturing lines so that problem chips could be traced back to a human or a machine problem. But that didn't help the fact that the chips had to get manufactured as quickly as possible because, well, the companies had to sell as many of the new chips as quickly as they could before the copycat chip companies jumped in. At the time, Japanese firms would get a set of any new chips and reverse engineer them. Then they would set up their own chip manufacturing line and sell the chips on the open market, far less expensively. If you don't already know it, designing and testing a new anything is almost always a far longer and expensive process than reverse engineering. Therefore, the cost of innovation, the bright idea, if you will, was not absorbed by the chip copy company. And that's not all. The labor market of the Japanese was far less expensive. Their standards were meticulous, and they could afford to do 100% testing of the chips they put out. This all added up to a nightmare. The reverse-engineered chips were better because of the innovation that was in them and their manufacturing process. The chips were faster because of the innovation as well, and they were much, much cheaper. The Silicon Valley chip company called the time between the new product announcement and the entry of Japanese chips into the market the honeymoon period. Once the cheaper chips were there, the honeymoon was over. Silicon Valley folks knew that they couldn't keep this up forever, and there was talk that the American electronics industry was doomed. But then something amazing happened. More and more of the chip manufacturing process was taken over by technology. The chips produced had fewer and fewer problems, and the manufacturing process itself became cheaper. It put the Japanese pretty much out of business. And eventually, with the World Trade Organization, the intellectual property behind the chips themselves became protected globally. So why remind us of this part of history? Well, remember all the worry about outsourcing work from the United States to other countries where the labor is so much cheaper? The Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. has published a study. It seems that the rise of automation is not only changing the profile of the American workforce, it's replacing many of the outsourced jobs performed in emerging countries for much less. Deja vu all over again. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, as a human race, are we better off or actually worse? You likely know Harvard professor Steven Pinker from such books as The Blank Slate and The Better Angels of Our Nature. He's here today with the data, and it's hard to argue with. Then on Tech Nation Health, chief correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft explores artificial intelligence today in healthcare and how you will see more of it in the future. Steven Pinker is the John Stone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University and the author of Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Well, Steven, welcome back to Tech Nation.
Thank you.
I picked up your book and I couldn't believe it. Here we are, no matter what anyone's politics are, everybody seems to be holding their head in their hands and saying the world is in terrible shape, and you write this optimistic look at our world.
Well, it's a defense of progress. What will happen in the future isn't completely determined by what happened in the past. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns, as the mutual funds say. But we really ought to appreciate the progress that we've made to know what we're in danger of losing and to know what we should cherish, what we should intensify going forward.
Well, you insist on giving us the facts. I count no fewer than 75 tables or charts, all definitively sourced, all simply presented. You might as well have named the book, What Are All You People Complaining About?
No, I do have some things that we could complain about or worry about. But we should also appreciate what we've accomplished. We're living longer. More of us are going to school. We're not dropping of infectious diseases. We are better entertained, we're better educated, we're richer. And by we, I don't just mean Americans and Europeans. I mean we citizens of the world. Not everyone, but many, many more than just even in the recent past.
You're writing about Enlightenment Now, and it refers back to a period of history called the Enlightenment. Take us back there.
So this is the period usually dated to the second half of the 18th century that had an explosion of ideas on both sides of the Atlantic that involved the primacy of reasoning. We shouldn't accept dogma and authority and tradition and revelation and faith, but we should try to figure things out, figure out how the world works. That also means science, because science is the application of reason to understanding the world. It's based on the conviction that the world is intelligible. We can figure out how it works by formulating possible hypotheses and testing them against reality. Humanism, the idea that the prime moral goal for all of us should be to enhance human flourishing, to make people better off. Now, I mean, that may sound so obvious that it's not worth giving a name to, but there are alternatives, such as that the prime moral purpose is to obey God's commandments, to achieve a good fate after you live in an afterlife, to glorify the nation or the race or the class or the faith, to achieve feats of artistic and military greatness. So the idea that we should make as many people as possible live long, healthy, happy lives is not as obvious as it sounds to us today. And finally, the Enlightenment thinkers believed that progress was possible, that they didn't try to hark back to a golden age. They didn't look ahead to some messianic utopia, but rather that if we apply our reason and science to improving the human condition, then bit by bit we can succeed.
Now, You list these as ideals. What does that mean?
Well, they combine factual beliefs, namely that the world is intelligible, with goals or moral beliefs that we ought to enhance human flourishing. And they're ideals in the sense that they are things that we ought to strive for. We should be as rational as possible. We should try to understand the world. We should enhance human flourishing.
And, of course, you were listing sort of the counter-enlightenments, you know, which you might call nationalism.
That's one, yep.
Totally. It's not trying to make everybody happy. It's us against the world.
Yes, that the world consists of a bunch of nation states, which are like tribes in competition for glory and preeminence, and they should compete. And the better one does, the worse another one will do. But that's the way it ought to be. That's kind of the nationalist's view of the planet. It has received some recent endorsement from our president and his advisors. But it is a distinct idea, and it's not the same as the idea that nations are kind of conveniences, constructions. They're ways that people can lead better lives. And that is very much an Enlightenment ideal, that the nation is simply or especially the government, is just a means for people to pursue life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And indeed, it is stipulated in so many words in the Declaration of Independence. What comes first? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In order to achieve them, nations are set up. That's very different from the idea that there are nations, and the individuals are making it up are just little bits and pieces. They're like the cells of a body, but what really counts is the nation. So that's an example of a clash between Enlightenment and counter-Enlightenment ideals. The counter-Enlightenment rose up in reaction to the Enlightenment in the 19th century, and it extolled virtues like the nation or the race tied to a plot of land, connected via a bloodline, defined by a culture and language. The Romantic movement was a kind of counter-Enlightenment movement. It claimed that the individual is a fiction, that really we're part of a seamless whole that involves the land that we live on and the culture that we're part of and the people that we're a constituent of. Of course, religious belief was very much a counter-Enlightenment ideal, that we should get our morality from Scripture, that we should accept Scripture's view of the nature of the world and the universe, and that what we should look to is going to heaven after we die. That is, this life is kind of, you know, disposable. Death is a rite of passage, but what really counts is how we spend eternity. And that also goes against the counter-Enlightenment emphasis on human beings in this world living the lives they live.
And of course, there's the ever popular, we are in a decline, civilization is collapsing.
Very much. That's right. So progress was an Enlightenment ideal that, again, is not necessarily a crowd pleaser. And so since the 19th century, there's been thinker after thinker and artist after artist and politician after politician saying, we are decadent, we are degenerate, we're teetering on the brink. Any day now, our civilization is going to collapse. They kind of divide into the ones that kind of wring their hands and fret about how sad this is, but it's nothing we can do to prevent it, and those who kind of welcome it, like life is so decadent and meaningless and soulless and consumerist, and it's about time that it collapses, and we don't know.
And it should.
Yeah, and anything is better than what we have now. Whatever will rise out of the ashes has got to be an improvement on the sick society that we're living in now.
And then we have, remembering that the scientific revolution predated or fed into the Age of Enlightenment, we have, instead of the embrace of science, we have the condemnation of science.
Yes, that science, even in universities, is often blamed for ills that are as old as civilization, slavery and racism and imperialism and colonialism, even though these took place centuries, millennia before the scientific
revolution.
Boy,
can we humans keep a grudge.
Right. But that's a very popular view among many academics, many intellectuals, especially those kind of more on the literary side of what's sometimes called the two cultures, a term that goes back to C.P. Snow, where one culture was science, the other culture, literary intellectuals and cultural critics. And there is a kind of a sneering among many of the culture of literary intellectuals that science is crass and evil and is responsible for the world wars and for racism. I argue that this is completely anachronistic, but it is a popular view. And then, of course, on the right, there is often a contempt for science when it clashes with cherished values like divine creation 5,000 years ago, or the idea that our hope lies in faith and trust in God and prayer. For example, there's a widespread belief among the Christian evangelical right that we shouldn't really try to do something about climate change because God wouldn't let anything bad happen in the long run. That's a surprisingly common belief.
That's good.
God. Yeah, it's scary. I mean, if you don't, yeah, if you don't have so much
I might
faith,
have to sign on to that.
You might sleep better, but one can say that it would be a kind of a...
Yeah, on a desperate day. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Steven Pinker, the John Stone Family Professor of Psychology at Harvard University. He's an experimental cognitive scientist and a prolific author in such topic areas as language, mind, and human nature. You know him from such books as The Blank Slate and The Better Angels of Our Nature. He's here today with Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. And let's talk about progress. I was looking at one of your figures, Tone of the News, 1945 to 2010 of the New York Times. And it was talking about pessimism. How does pessimism relate to progress?
Yeah, progress takes place despite all the pessimists. But the graph that you were just alluding to comes from an analysis by a data scientist named Kalev Litaru, who used a technique called sentiment mapping, which tallied up just the number of positive words and negative words in a huge sample of news articles, starting from the 40s. One sample was all of the content of the New York Times. Another was a sample of news sources all over the world. And both of them went down, down, down. Even though the 1940s, the world had just come out of the worst war in history. There was widespread poverty and hunger. There was racial discrimination codified in the law in the United States. The half of Europe was behind the Iron Curtain. There were horrific wars in the partition of India. The Korean War was about to come. The Chinese Civil War, a grotesquely destructive war. But they were much cheerier than we are now, with a fraction of the number of wars, with the world much richer, extreme poverty worldwide at its lowest point ever. And now's when the papers are glum and morose.
Exactly. And this only went to 2010. When I think about just how people talk today and how the media in all its varieties are, everyone is unhappy. They just happen to severely disagree.
As to what they should be unhappy about.
Exactly.
Well, here's an interesting phenomenon, though. There is a phenomenon called the optimism gap, which pollsters have documented for quite a while, which is that it's not that people are that unhappy, but they're really angry about the society because they think everyone else is unhappy for reasons that they are upset about. So if you ask people, how good is your kid's school? They say, oh, it's not bad. You say, how good are the nation's schools? Oh, they're terrible. How safe is your neighborhood? Oh, it's pretty safe. How safe is your city? Oh, it's a jungle. And how happy are you? How happy is the average person? And people underestimate the happiness of the country by 30 or 40 percentage points. So everyone thinks that everyone else is miserable. And a lot of voting behavior isn't driven so much by personal interests. There's always the puzzle. How come people don't vote their pocketbooks? Why do poor people vote or working class people vote for tax cuts for the rich? The thing is that a lot of voting really isn't, it can't be for your personal interest because your vote really doesn't make a difference, frankly.
One at a time.
one vote, exactly. One at a time, it doesn't make a difference. So for an individual person, they're really not voting their pocketbook or anything else. They're expressing themselves. They're expressing their theory as to which way the world is going, which tribe they belong to, which candidate seems to represent what they value in life. But a lot of what we call the anger of the voter isn't so necessarily anger at their personal situation, but rather their assessment of which way the country is going.
Well, I kept reading these charts, and I'm reading the text, and I was seeing how challenging it was in some instances, because so many times the data was clear. I mean, cost of air travel down, way down, minuscule. You can fly anywhere. People do all the time.
There used to be this term called the jet set for rich people, because they were the only ones who could afford to fly by jet. Now it's an anachronistic term.
Global well-being, up. Measure. We could see that going up. But then you've got some things that I'm trying to figure out. The number of people living in extreme poverty, seriously down. If you look at the percentage, but it's still sort of the same number of people, because we've got such an expansion of the population.
So interestingly, that isn't exactly true. That astonishingly, not only is the rate of extreme poverty down, but the number of people in extreme poverty has gone down, even as the world's population has increased.
So it's even gone
down.
Even the
absolute numbers have gone down, which is amazing considering how much the population has grown. But that gives you a sense as to how dramatic the decline of extreme poverty has been, that even with a burgeoning population, fewer bodies are in extreme poverty. So now that, of course, this doesn't mean that we can relax and that we shouldn't be concerned about extreme poverty, because if, say, 10% of the world lives in extreme poverty, that's 700 million people. That's a lot of misery. And that's just another way of saying, making the same point, 10%, the global poverty rate is 10%. That's a good way of putting it. 700 million people are in extreme poverty. That's
not okay.
it's certainly not okay. And in fact, the United Nations has set as one of its sustainable development goals eliminating extreme poverty everywhere by 2030. Now, that's quite an optimistic goal. It's only a dozen years from now. We'll be alive to see it. Now, it probably won't meet that goal. That it is so ambitious. But it might come close. I mean, the last pockets of extreme poverty are going to be the hardest to alleviate. And so it may be a little bit too optimistic. On the other hand, the Millennium Development Goals, which were the predecessor of the Sustainable Development Goals, a lot of those targets were met ahead of schedule, including the reduction of extreme poverty.
Only problems get solved, and it ain't a problem till you say it's a problem.
Well, that's right. Yes. And I mean, you need to see it's a problem, and you also have to have the confidence that problems are solvable.
It does point out to me how difficult it is, the challenge it is to get the data in a way that you can see it. You don't just pick out, I could tell, you just didn't pick out figures and throw them up. What am I really communicating here? And for the reader, what am I seeing? And it's a tremendous challenge to try to get the right perspective on what it is you're looking at.
Indeed. And it was a lesson that I learned in writing a previous book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And I knew that people would be so incredulous at the claim that violence had declined that only by plotting graphs so they could see it with their own eyes would readers believe it. So, for example, a graph on per capita rate of death in wars since 1945. And it's a bit of a roller coaster. There's some ups and downs, but the overall impression is that it's down, down, down. And it's from maybe about 22 per 100,000 per year in around the time of the Korean War, down to 1.2 just when the book was published, which was just before the Syrian Civil War, nicked it up a bit. And in Enlightenment Now, I update a number of the graphs from The Better Angels of Our Nature. And there's no question that there's an upward blip since Better Angels was published, representing the horrific Syrian Civil War. But it doesn't, looking at the graph, you can see that even though it's a turn in the wrong direction, it doesn't erase the progress that we've enjoyed. We're still not anywhere near the levels that we were in the 1980s when there was the Iran-Iraq War. Most people have forgotten about that. In the 60s and 70s with the Vietnam War, in the early 50s and late 40s with the Korean War and the Chinese Civil War. So seeing the graph gives you a kind of appreciation that you can't get from a verbal description, and it's because we're primates, we're visual creatures.
And then there are deaths from terrorism.
Yes, so deaths, that's another surprise when you look at it quantitatively, because terrorism commands our attention, gets saturation news coverage, and of course that's the whole point of terrorism. That's what we call it, terrorism. It's a device designed to generate terror. But it actually is not a major factor in violence. That the number of people who are killed in just ordinary barroom homicides or, you know, road rage, domestic violence, dwarfs the number of deaths from terrorism or from rampage shooters. And if you care about a person's chance of dying at the hands of another human being, what you really should look at is homicide, not terrorism. And it's only by looking at numbers that you can appreciate how minor a phenomenon terrorism is, other than in whipping up emotions. And even with even when you plot the rate of terrorism over time, you see that actually, except for 9/11, which just jumps out of the graph, the worst terrorist act in history. And as we remember, at the time, this was supposed to be a harbinger of an age of terrorism. There were going to be weekly attacks on the scale of 9/11. That didn't happen. But if you set aside 9/11, then actually the world probably has less terrorism now than it did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the heyday of radical Marxist groups and secessionist groups. And the Basque terrorists, the Irish Republicans, the Baader-Meinhof gang. And so Western Europe in particular had much higher rates of terrorism there.
60s, 70s, 80s, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have constant updates from our phones. We had three in the U.S. We had three major networks plus maybe a local one. You had to get there at 6 o'clock at night if you wanted to see the evening news. You picked up the morning paper. You had a solid 24-hour news cycle, if not more. We didn't know about most of the things that were going on.
Well, I think that's right, yes. We didn't. I mean, the Vietnam War was said to be the first war brought into Americans' living rooms. So there was some awareness, more awareness of the Vietnam War than other wars while they were unfolding, where a lot of the battleground photography was only released after the war. Often wartime censors would not allow grisly pictures to be published as the war was going on because it would demoralize the country. So Vietnam had more of it. Now we have still more. Even though we have fewer wars and less destructive wars, we see more of them.
I'm speaking with Harvard professor Steven Pinker about Enlightenment Now, the case for reason, science, humanism, and progress. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Tech Nation Health are available on NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on Tech Nation Health, Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft talks about artificial intelligence in healthcare. It's here, it's real, and it's not going away. Stay with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Harvard professor Steven Pinker about his book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. Well, it's this perception of data that I really want to call attention to. You don't talk about this in the book, but I happened to look at it the other day, and it's an analysis of Trump's tweets since he was inaugurated. How many are on what subject? How many? Well, what happens is that you read or you hear or you see one that's a particularly of some note at any one time, but you don't have a sense for how many there are and how they're grouped together and how they begin to make sort of a sense, or they have a pattern. And it's like, wow, that's kind of interesting. I mean, I don't know. I didn't know how many he wrote on this topic versus that topic. And I think that's another thing that comes through here. You've got to collectively take data over time to understand what it is you're looking at.
Yeah, very much. We're awash in data, and more of it is being generated and collated. But we do need ways of digesting it, and that's going to mean creative visualizations. And there's a new kind of an art form almost. I mean, we're halfway between art and science of how do you get people to appreciate multidimensional dynamic data given our puny powers of quantitative thinking. And I have great admiration for the scientists, the data scientists, the graphic designers, the artists who come up with clever ways of displaying data in ways that can be understood. I mean, a famous example is from the late Swedish doctor Hans Rosling, who became a TED Talk star. Among other things, he swallowed a sword. He emerged from a washing machine to argue that the washing machine is the most important invention of the Industrial Revolution for liberating women and giving us back a day of our lives. But among the things that he did, and he was quite the showman, but he devised a way of showing human progress dynamically in a bubble graph that probably a number of listeners have either seen in TED Talks or on websites, where the two axes are lifespan and wealth, GDP per capita. Each dot is a country. The size of the dot represents the population of the country. They're color-coded as to which continent they appear in, and they're animated. So at first, all of the dots, the bubbles, are crowded into the lower left-hand corner. This is in, say, 1820. Basically, the whole world was sick and poor and died young.
Then you not see, a good time.
Not a good time. Forget the good old days. Yeah. Forget the golden age. People dropped like flies, and they were poor. And then you see the bubbles for Britain, for the Netherlands, for the United States, kind of floating out from that cluster packed into the lower left-hand corner, meaning that they were getting richer and they were living longer, floating up along the diagonal to the upper right. And then a gap opens up. So there are like a few fortunate countries and most of the world living in squalor. But then in the last minute of the animation, corresponding to the last few decades, you see a mass of countries escaping that lower left-hand corner, slithering up the diagonal, meaning that their people were living longer and richer. And then you see sub-Saharan Africa, the world's poorest region, those countries starting to move up the diagonal. So it's an example of human history involving thousands of data points rendered as almost like a not quite a cartoon, but certainly a beautiful and informative visual display.
What I like about the Hans Rosling charts is that he often includes where does technology play a part? Where does science play a part? You know, because he was very interested in public health. That was part of one of his fields. And it's like when science could come along and understand what caused some of these diseases, and technology could then be brought about so you could actually treat it. Once they exist, whole populations can catch up really fast.
Yes, because ideas are, they don't weigh anything. They don't cost anything to spread. They're information, they're bits, and they can be duplicated without loss. I mean, it's like the old saying, you teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. Information can be duplicated without loss. I mean, that's why that has some consequences that we don't know how to deal with, like piracy and the damage done to the recording industry and the news industry as people get all these things cheap or free, and the business model can't keep up with it. But on the other hand, it does have the advantage that if you discover a way of sanitizing water or increasing crop yields, you can share it, and it doesn't cost anything to share it, and people can be an order of magnitude better off.
And that's a definition of progress for the whole human race. Once we figure it out at one level, it can spread throughout all humanity.
Exactly. And that is a key Enlightenment idea, that knowledge is the source of human improvement. And it can be because of this uncanny ability to be duplicated. Thomas Jefferson had a wonderful analogy. He said that when I share an idea with someone, I suffer no loss in the same way as when I light someone's candle with mine. I can light his without mine going out.
Now we get to the big chart. Populist support across generations. You've got three lines. Brexit, Trump, and European populist parties. Describe this chart to us. I'm not quite sure I understood it when I looked at it.
Well, so this is not a chart that plots anything over time. It plots it over age. So what percentage of, say, millennials, people in their 20s, voted for Trump? What percentage of baby boomers? What percentage of the silent generation, the people born before World War II, and everything in between? And all three graphs show a huge fall off. Basically, the older you are, the more populism appeals to you. At least that was true. Those aren't data from last year, but they were data from the year before last, 2016. And they show that populism is something of an old man's movement.
And what is populism?
So this is the, I'd say, a counter-Enlightenment movement that we see in Trump. We see to some extent, in Brexit. We see in the parties that have gained power in some Eastern European countries like Poland and Hungary, and that have made inroads in others, that seek kind of direct power in the hands of a particular people, often a particular ethnic group, in practice often the kind of traditional white population of the country, but with their interests embodied in a charismatic leader who just symbolizes their inherent wisdom and virtue. The movement tends to be distrustful to contemptuous of expertise. It tends to be nationalist, that is hostile to organizations of international cooperation, the European Union being the prime example, opposed to immigration because it contaminates the nation conceived of as a homeland for an ethnic group, often not particularly partial to democracy because it has all of these burdensome rules and regulations and fiduciary duties and a deep state and an administrative state that, since the people is inherently good, if you have a leader that embodies the virtue of the people, why saddle him with all of these annoying regulations? And so the idea of democracy being a government of laws and not men, and built-in constraints on the power of an executive, the checks and balances, that doesn't particularly resonate strongly with populism.
Now we get to part three. Yeah, it's like, wow, how long is this book? Well, it's not that long, but there's sure a lot in it.
Shorter than a typical president's biography.
Oh, as an example. You go back to reason, science, humanism, but we're talking about the progress that we need to go from here. Let's just wrap up with that perspective, if you will.
Yeah, so I have a chapter apiece defending what I consider to be the three main ideals of the Enlightenment, the ones that make progress possible. I have a chapter on reason, which defends the primacy of reason against an argument that actually sometimes comes from my own field, cognitive psychology. Since cognitive psychologists have shown all the ways in which people can be irrational, We generalize from stereotypes and from examples. We use our own experience as a source of information about the world. Just what's the first thing you can think of? Well, that must be what's happening. We're overconfident about our own wisdom, our own knowledge. We selectively prosecute our own favored causes by slurping up data that supports them and blowing off data that goes against them, so we don't take an unbiased reading of the evidence, but act more like lawyers to try to advance our cause and try to win arguments. So, and these are all true. They've been documented over and over yes. again. They replicate. But it does not mean that, first of all, it doesn't mean that the Enlightenment thinkers would be surprised by any of these findings. The contrary to a totally incorrect belief about the Enlightenment. They didn't think we were all Mr. Spock, that we were all perfectly rational, or that the society depended on everyone acting rationally. Quite the contrary. I mean, a lot of the mechanisms of democracy were designed to achieve a rational outcome, despite the fact that all the people who are taking part in it aren't so rational. Likewise, science. The whole point of science is you don't get to impose your authority. No one is going to believe you just because you're a big shot, but everything has to be debated, peer-reviewed, empirically tested, and that the main impediment to scientific progress is the fact that we fool ourselves. We scientists fool ourselves. And so the whole rules of the game of science are designed to stop us from fooling ourselves. And the idea that The bigger idea is not that people are rational, but people obviously must be capable of rationality. Otherwise, we could never argue about whether they're rational or not, because we wouldn't know what rationality is. The fact that we're even having this discussion means that we must have some idea of what's rational in order to say, well, humans aren't it. So some of us, some of the time, clearly can pinpoint what's rational. And we do it in systems of logic and evidence. And the point is, the reason that we extol reason is not to praise human beings, quite the contrary, but rather to set up institutions and norms and rules of the game that make us collectively more rational than any of us are individually. And the proof that we reason must be the ultimate guide is that if you make an argument that reason shouldn't be the ultimate guide, well, why should we believe that line of argument unless it's reasonable? And if it is reasonable, then it's saying that it's defeating itself because it's falling right back on reason. So I have a chapter on science. And again, you know, some people say, well, why would anyone need a defense of science? Isn't science ascendant? But in fact, as I briefly mentioned before, science gets really kind of trashed in a lot of university departments and courses. It's blamed for racism. And I argue that that's anachronistic, that in fact the huge increase in nationalism and racism in Europe that eventually led to fascism and Nazism really came from mythology, from philology, from linguistics, from cockamamie theories that a great race of manly men spilled out of an ancestral homeland thousands of years ago, the Aryans or the Indo-Europeans, and turned into the Homeric Greeks and the Goths, and the Indian invaders of the subcontinent, and that the Persians, and that everything has been going downhill since they interbred with the inferior peoples that they conquered. Now, I mean, this is utter nonsense, but it was an amazingly popular view among a whole swath of intellectuals, philosophers, and the idea that we should blame science for this. I mean, certainly scientists were to blame. They got caught up in this zeitgeist, but it was, I argue, not a scientific theory that gave rise to these ideas. And then a chapter on humanism. Again, you might say, does it really need a defense? And the answer is it does, because there are religious alternatives, as we discussed earlier. And then there's a alternative that the ultimate good is to promote the great man, the Ubermensch, the Superman, the brilliant artist, the military conqueror, and that the mass of people count for nothing, that it's greatness that we should think about.
Well, Stephen, it is always a pleasure. You know, you're always welcome on Tech Nation.
I'd love to be back.
My guest today is Harvard professor Steven Pinker. The book is Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress. It's published by Viking. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies and breakthrough science. It seems that the term artificial intelligence, or as it's referred to, AI, has been overpromised and overhyped for years. And yet we're seeing changes as a result of AI all around us. I thought I might ask Tech Nation Health Chief Correspondent Dr. Daniel Kraft about areas in healthcare where that might be true, starting with radiology. I mean, who hasn't had an X-ray?
I always like to say that, you know, we're moving from this sort of hype cycle of artificial intelligence, AI, to IA, intelligence augmentation. And particularly in radiology, which is one of those fields full of data and more data, there's, you know, more scans done, the resolution of CT scans and MRIs is going up exponentially. That's to the point where no radiologist can look at every single film, every single slice. So one of the exciting areas where machine learning, big data, AI have come together in the last few years is to now take our now digitized X-rays. You know, back when I trained, we still took our X-rays that were sort of printed on film paper, put them on the light box. We looked at them and said, oh, that little dot shadow there, that might be a pneumonia. Well, now we can digitize those. I can look at radiology films from almost any hospital on my smartphone and apply the lens of machine learning, AI, and big data to those X-rays. And it could be an X-ray, it could be a CT scan, an ultrasound. So here we are, you know, speaking right now in November 2017. Just this last week was the RSNA conference, a big convergence of radiologists from around the world. One of the big issues is, where is this taking radiology? Because today there are already companies like Enlytic here in San Francisco, Zebra Biomedical out of Israel, a company called Arteris that spun out of Stanford, where they're taking the scans from CT scans, MRIs, and beyond, and now can say, that patient looks like they have pneumonia. That patient looks like they have a nodule that is probably benign or is cancerous. And this threatens, to some degree, how radiologists will practice. Frankly, we probably need them not to be replaced, but to be augmented by these skills. So they're not looking at every standard chest X-ray for screening, but can spend their time and attention on the scans that have the most need for higher intellectual investment and collaboration. But we're rapidly getting to the point, again, where almost every X-ray will probably have a pre-read, just like some mammograms are being done today. Every CT scan and every element will not do the entire reading, but highlight the elements that need to be paid attention to. And as we can start to crowdsource this data, what machine learning and AI is good is saying, this is the characteristics of a dangerous nodule versus a non-dangerous one. And I think it's going to continue to explode to the point where we are going to be able to have lower cost radiology, better imaging data, and get that faster. Because if I'm in the emergency room or in the clinic, I'm still often waiting sometimes a day or more to get that read back, and sometimes it's super time critical.
Well, I have to tell people all the time, and they say, well, how could a computer be, how do I trust this? It's going to be, you know, that a human is so much better at this. And I say, well, you see 16 frames a second, and you think the image is moving.
So, right, and humans are, they get tired.
We're limited.
They're limited. We get tired. We have biases. There was, a recent publication out of Stanford, Andrew Ng's group, who's a pretty well-known AI researcher, is now applying his lens to healthcare, where they've now trained their systems to look at chest X-rays. And it was beating, in terms of a competition they sort of set up in their publication, very experienced, regular chest radiologists. So we want, hopefully, our doctor or our AI enhanced clinicians to be always up to speed on the latest research, publications, data that can come not just from an academic center like Stanford or UCSF, but from around the world. And so what does a radiologist, a pathologist, a dermatologist do? They do often pattern recognition. And what does machine learning and AI do well is pattern recognition and keep improving over time. And can, just like we saw with the famous game Go, which Google's DeepMind project learned to beat the grand champion in Go, their next version of Go, without even playing any games, taught itself to beat the prior version of Go. So as we sort of add these elements in, we're going to see dramatic impacts in things like dermatology, radiology, pathology. And again, not to have your doctor replaced by an AI or robot, but to have them upskilled and to have better access to true real-time information from around the world.
Good point. This isn't a competition. This is an augmentation on one side. And when it gets better at many things, it actually frequently trains the doctor. The doctor gets better saying, oh, I now see something more. Now you're pointing this out. Now you're learning more. And so it's a friendly team between the doctor and the better technology. It's not one subsuming the other.
Right. And a team eventually with each of us as individual consumers and patients that, you know, already today my smartwatch can look at my heart rate. And if it's not regular or if it's higher than it should be and I'm not moving, it can go, hey, Daniel, maybe something's going on, and diagnose something like atrial fibrillation, an irregular heart rhythm. That's a little form of simple AI. In the future, that's going to get more synthesized from our connected homes, our Internet of Things, where our connected mattress will track our resting heart rate and sleep, where our Amazon Echoes might be listening to our voice and seeing changes. And again, hopefully that teams with our clinicians and healthcare systems, leveraging the sort of machine learning AI lever to pick up things early rather than late.
Well, we all have skin. What about artificial intelligence and dermatology? I mean, is it any more than just taking a picture of a spot on our hand?
I think dermatology is probably the most obvious spot for AI machine learning to play a role in that. It is already happening. Today, there are several apps you can download and take a picture of a funny spot on your skin and send it to a real dermatologist who will send you a preliminary diagnosis. Is that a melanoma or a mole? But several groups have now published and even demonstrated at big dermatology conferences when they put the pictures on the screen that they can beat out more than 80% of the experienced dermatologists there in identifying what that lesion is.
And so you hope it goes through a computer analysis on the way to the dermatologist reviewing your
right,
picture.
Or in some cases may replace the common screening that a dermatologist may do. Your primary care doctor may see a funny rash, try to get you to see a dermatologist, but it's a 2-month wait. There are systems like Kaiser Permanente that have a whole e-derm system where they can take a picture, send it asynchronously, and can be looked at by a dermatologist. Increasingly, that will be done by apps and machine learning. Again, we need to align the incentives and the regulatory process. How do you regulate an app that you may have that might screen you for cancer? How do you know it's accurate or not and sensitive and specific? Because we don't want a bunch of false positives going out there. At the same time, we want to be able to identify folks who might have missed that skin lesion, have that positive screen, and then go in and see the dermatologist who can do the biopsy. So this shouldn't necessarily, again, replace dermatologists, but hopefully bring them to the clinic, the folks who really need to get seen, hopefully sooner, and that will save lives and dollars.
And now, at the end of the day, we all leave this earth. What about pathology?
Pathology is still, I wouldn't say in the dark ages, but still in the glass slide ages where, you know, let's see if something biopsied from in your body on your skin gets sliced and diced, put on the scope, and someone looks down the glass tubes and at the microscope and says, well, this looks normal, or some stage of a disease based on their experience. Now we're seeing the advent of digital pathology where even there are some robotic devices that'll slice up the tumor, image them, 3D reconstruct them, and then can apply that same lens we could apply to dermatology and radiology to pathology slides, pathology elements, and is going to give us a lot more insight into disease and how to diagnose this, because frankly, there's still a lot of misdiagnosis going on. You may have the world's best pathologist at one academic center in the U.S. or some other location in the world. Now you can hopefully apply that mindset of the best pathologists from around the world and that in an increasingly global data set to compare your pathology with others and make the most accurate, timely diagnosis.
And once your pathology is digitized, it can be sent to any number of people who can look at it and any number of programs that can look at it.
It could be a computer looking at it. It could be the power of the crowd. We've seen examples now in public health or global health with malaria. So the way you diagnose malaria, someone comes in with some fevers. They may have been a part of the world with malaria carried by mosquitoes. You take a blood smear, you look on that blood smear in the microscope for these little spirochetes that are indicative of different forms of malaria. That's done visually today. Now you don't maybe have anyone in the clinic there to do it. You can upload it to the cloud and a volunteer mom in Ohio can be screening those and scoring them. And it won't be just one person, it might be 10 of them. And when the score is high enough, it's going to give you a positive answer. And as we start to learn what those things look like, just like other machine learnings have been trained by humans, we're going to train with the power of the crowd, and both the lay public and experienced pathologists, radiologists, dermatologists, how to identify those signals, and the machine learning will continue to improve with the help, the collaboration of the human side of the equation. And there's fear around this, right? You know, Elon Musk and others have raised the specter of what happens when the AIs take over. There's a lot of, again, stress in the medical community. What's the role of the diagnostician, of the clinician? I think we still definitely need to pay attention to the human side of the equation. It's not just having the AI diagnosis or therapy calculated. How do you interact with your nurse, your doctor? That human touch is therapeutic in itself. We've seen studies now with stents in cardiac disease, with sham stents being placed, where the outcomes were the same. They still went through a procedure. They thought they may have gotten it. The outcomes were the same. We're going to learn what is that real placebo effect, maybe even how to leverage that and understand that the human contact part, whether it's human empathy directly or digital empathy through an app or SMS or FaceTime, that can be part of this equation. So I want to again, emphasize that we shouldn't sort of be afraid that AI will take over and replace doctors, nurses, et cetera, but can be an important layer, and it can hopefully give us more time for the human part, the communication, the hand-holding, the decision-making, the empathy that can be an incredibly important part of the health and wellness side, as well as the patient journey when you're diagnosed with an acute or chronic condition.
And these artificial intelligence computer programs didn't come out of the air. They didn't drop from the sky. Richard Feynman, the physicist, is famous for saying, "I cannot build what I don't understand." It's a reflection of what humans understand that are in these programs.
At the beginning, but as I understand it today with some of the work from Google DeepMind and others, they're starting to solve things and create things that they don't understand where the elements come from. We also don't want to just be assigning big data sets. How do we accelerate our ability to think and reason, right? It's one issue. You have a simple puzzle you can do with two or three elements. But when you go to the end of the power of 9 or 10 or beyond, sometimes the way these solutions get solved won't be something that we can just back calculate in our human sense.
Well, I really look forward to the day when the patient comes into you and says, instead of, "Hey, doc, do you have some medicine for me?" it's, "Hey, doc, do you have a placebo for me?" Because that'd be really great.
And that placebo might need to be tuned to you. I mean, how we respond to stress or the pill, whether it's the red pill or the green one, may be very dependent on you and understanding your psychology. And so all these things are going to play an important role in today and the future of health and medicine. It's not just AI or big data or omics. It's this convergence and the super convergence. It's going to give us the potential to really shift things across the healthcare continuum.
Thanks for coming in, Daniel.
Thank you, Moira.
Dr. Daniel Kraft is chief correspondent of TechNation Health and the founder and chair of Exponential Medicine. More information is available at exponentialmedicine.com. For TechNation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BiotechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at TechNation.com. TechNation and BiotechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Landcor.